The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and/or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. Today, I will read a story from the March 9, 2026 issue of the New Yorker, The Man Who Broke Into Jail. In Nashville, a criminal justice activist commits a baffling crime, by James Verini. Lieutenant Thomas Conrad was standing in a control room in Nashville's new central jail when he noticed something off with one of the key rings hanging on the wall. It was midday on December 30, 2019, and in 2 weeks, the still empty jail would take in about 700 inmates. While contractors were finishing their work, Conrad, a senior correctional officer with the Davidson County Sheriff's Office, was organizing equipment. Handheld radios, handcuffs, and keys. Conrad had been an infantryman in Iraq, where he'd learned to spot slight inconsistencies in the landscape. Looking more closely at the key ring, he realized what was wrong. It was circular. All the others were horseshoe-shaped. The key rings were fastened with hard plastic locks. The lock on the circular ring, Conrad saw, was cracked. On each key ring was a disc stamped with the number of keys that should be in the set. The disc on the circular ring was stamped 18. Conrad counted the keys three times. There were only 16. He phoned Lieutenant Timothy Dial, the jail's key control officer, and said, "I'm going to need you to come down here." Dial arrived. "We don't use rings like this," he told Conrad. "It's got to be maintenance," Conrad said. Speculating that a cleaner had somehow broken the original key ring, he radioed the maintenance crew. The plastic lock on the mysterious key set was yellow, signifying restricted, because it held a general movement key that could open almost any door in the jail. Dial consulted a key inventory spreadsheet. The general movement key was one of the two that were missing. A maintenance crewman arrived. "It wasn't us," he said. The downtown detention center, as the new jail was called, had been under construction for more than 3 years. Once open, it would house every arrestee in Nashville. The building occupied a block near the state capitol on a plot of land where Nashville's old central jail had stood for 35 years. That jail, notoriously violent and corrupt, had symbolized the good old boy era of Nashville law enforcement, and the downtown detention center was replacing it both physically and symbolically. The new jail had tablet computers for inmates and a behavioral care center for mentally ill arrestees, the first of its kind in an American jail. The facility reflected changing attitudes toward criminal justice in Nashville, which in recent decades has become a tourism and business destination and a progressive bastion in a state sometimes called the Buckle of the Bible Belt. At 2 p.m., Conrad and Dial met with Brian Beasley, the jail's electronic security officer, who managed its surveillance cameras. Beasley pulled up footage from the control room that housed the keys, zoomed in on the hook where Conrad had found the circular key ring, and pressed rewind. The footage found nothing unusual until December 27th at 12:54 p.m., 3 days earlier, when the circular ring suddenly disappeared from its hook. Beasley rewound another few seconds. A purple hand appeared in the frame. "What the hell?" he said. They pulled up the same moment as recorded by another camera, which showed a wider view. The purple hand was attached to a man they didn't recognize. He appeared to be a laborer, wearing a hard hat, a reflective vest, and purple nitrile gloves. Laborers weren't allowed in the key control room. They rewound at 10:44 a.m., pressed play, and watched as the laborer walked in. Short and of slight build, he carried a bucket. His face was obscured by glasses and a dust mask. This was strange. The pandemic was still months away, and most of the construction tasks requiring a mask, plastering, insulation, were finished. Conrad and Beasley watched as the man grabbed a key set and tried, unsuccessfully, to pry open the lock with a screwdriver. At 10:57 a.m., he pocketed another set with a yellow lock on its horseshoe ring and left the room. At 12:54 p.m., he returned and replaced it. The lock was still yellow, but now the ring was circular. Tony Wilkes, the chief of corrections at the Davidson County Sheriff's Office, was overseeing the jail's construction. He got word of the incident to the sheriff himself, Darren Hall, who was in Florida for the holidays. Hall had worked in the sheriff's office since the 80s. As a case manager at the old jail, he'd known of beatings, murder, suicide, sadistic officers. After he was elected sheriff in 2002, he began envisioning a more humane jail. Hall believes that incarceration can provide inmates with better opportunities. He dislikes the word rehabilitation, he told me. Rehabilitation assumes there was habilitation. A lot of these people had no chance to make it. The new jail, a $175 million project, was the culmination of Hall's career. He was staking that career, along with any future he might have in state politics, on the jail's success. Beasley continued reviewing footage and noticed that the infiltrators' reflective vests bore the insignia of the security firm that had installed the cameras. Beasley showed a still image of the man to a firm supervisor. He didn't recognize him. Nobody did. Wilkes briefed Hall, who said, "We have to find him." Conrad and Dial showed still images to the others at the jail and devised a plan of capture should the man return. Hall waited for 5 days, thinking, at times hoping, that he might never hear of the infiltrator again. But on January 4th, 2020, someone appeared outside the jail's lobby. The officer on duty, Corey Witkus, recognized him with a jolt. The man was wearing a dust mask and carrying an igloo cooler. Witkus, having been warned that the infiltrator might be armed, kept in mind the Glock on his utility belt as he buzzed him in. "Hey, what do you have going on today?" Witkus said casually. "I'm here to work," the man in the mask said in a soft, cordial voice. Witkus offered to show him to where the other laborers were working, and the man thanked him. Witkus led him to a passageway whose windowed doors on either end could be locked remotely. He instructed the man to proceed to the far door. Once the man was inside, Witkus slipped back out and radioed officers in the master control room, telling them to keep the doors locked, then radioed Dial and Conrad. The police were called as Conrad raced to the passageway, arriving as the man was trying to open the far door. The man smacked the window. "Let me out," he yelled. "I'm here to work." He rushed back to the first door and, finding it locked, began pacing. After 10 minutes, he came to a sudden halt. He pulled a piece of paper from his pocket, lowered his dust mask, stuffed the paper in his mouth, and chewed. He pulled another piece of paper from his wallet and chewed that, spitting the wad into a trash bin. He had been locked inside for 45 minutes when police entered the passageway, followed by Conrad, Wilkes, and Dial. The police asked the man his name. He didn't respond. Conrad told him to remove the mask. He didn't move. "Man, take that mask off," Wilkes said angrily. Conrad pulled down the mask. The man gazed at Wilkes, whose expression went from exasperation to shock. "That's Alex Friedman," Wilkes said. The man silently looked at the floor. Wilkes phoned Hall's chief of staff. "You're not going to believe this," he said. "We got Alex freaking Friedman." When news of the arrest got out, people who knew Friedman were similarly shocked. So were those who only knew of him. Friedman was one of the most respected prison reform activists in America. He was the associate director of the Human Rights Defense Center, a prisoner's rights organization, and the president of the Private Corrections Institute, a watchdog group that monitors the for-profit prison industry. He was the managing editor of Prison Legal News, a newspaper written by and for inmates. He often addressed the Tennessee legislature and had testified before Congress. He had spoken at ACLU and NAACP conferences, lectured at law schools, and consulted on prison legislation for Bernie Sanders. Friedman was the sort of activist that people who normally can't abide activists could appreciate. He seemed more like a professor, maintaining a neat white goatee and wearing button-down shirts, ties, and rimless glasses. Allies and critics alike described him as brilliant and single-mindedly devoted to his cause, yet also as so rational and eloquent that he won over law and order conservatives and recalcitrant public officials. He could be vain, but he was better known for his gentleness. John Ray Clemens, a legislator in the Tennessee House of Representatives, described him to me as someone who just cared very deeply. Janet Wolf, a fellow activist in Nashville and a close friend of Friedman's, mentioned how incredibly wise he was in trying to help other people understand the plight of prisoners. Demetria Kalodimos, a former news anchor on Nashville's NBC station, told me that Friedman was one of her best contacts for criminal justice stories. She valued him both as a source and as an on-camera expert because he spoke the language of a lawyer, not of a social justice warrior. Friedman, a member of Mensa, who taught himself civil case law, could write like a lawyer too, in briefs and legal articles. He could also write like an author. He was a guest columnist at the Tennessean newspaper and had won a PEN America Award for playwriting. People especially trusted Friedman's expertise because they knew he had earned it through experience. When he was 18, he had been charged with armed robbery and attempted murder, and he had been imprisoned for nearly a decade. Prison reform activists tend not to call incarcerated people prisoners or inmates, preferring the term insider with its more flattering connotations of hard-won knowledge. Friedman was the insider's insider. His condemnation of the American penal system came out of his time in brutal detention facilities, including Nashville's old jail. Through pertinacity and patience, he had penetrated the corridors of power. But prison had not turned Friedman into an abolitionist. He objected not to the existence of prisons, but to their conditions. Jeannie Alexander, another Nashville activist and friend, who is an abolitionist, told me that she couldn't interest Friedman in sit-ins that she organized. He was never going to start a riot, she said. He always worked with the system. Friedman had improved the lives of countless American prisoners through the courts, the legislative process, and the press. Like Hall, he believed that penitentiaries, if managed humanely, could better inmates. He was living proof. Nobody was more surprised by Friedman's turn back to crime than Hall. The two had first met a year and a half before Friedman's arrest at the jail, but they had known each other by reputation long before that. Hall had worked as a case manager at Nashville's old jail while Friedman was locked up there. Later, Hall worked for Corrections Corporation of America, which operated another prison where Friedman was incarcerated. When Friedman got out and became an activist and a journalist, he often consulted with Hall's staff. In 2018, the sheriff's office invited Friedman to join a group of outside advisors on jail reform, and in the months before Friedman's arrest, Hall had met with him many times. He appreciated Friedman's seriousness, and the feeling was mutual. Friedman lauded Hall in the Tennessean. When he learned of the arrest, Hall said he couldn't believe it. Hall's chief deputy at the time, John Ford, told me that the arrest was a holy S-word moment, adding, "He's been in and out of our jails, he's been in meetings with us, and he's doing this right behind our backs?" Ford didn't know what Friedman had been up to in the jail, but sensed that he was getting ready to commit an awful crime. On the afternoon of his arrest, Friedman phoned his wife, Alice. He didn't sound like a man with a sinister plan. His affect was dainty, and his voice was as soft as it had been when he'd greeted Witkus in the lobby. "Hello, dear," he said on the call, which was recorded. "I have been arrested. Do not get terribly concerned." He asked Alice to fetch a pencil and a paper. After she retrieved them, he said cheerily, "Good deal." She asked why he'd been arrested. "They're charging me with burglary and destruction of evidence, which sounds rather far-fetched," he said. When she suggested raising cash for a bail bond, Friedman offered the only hint that he was in deep trouble. The problem with a cash bond was that, quote, "they don't return it until the entire case is disposed of, which might take a good long while," end quote. Nevertheless, Alice put a $5,000 down payment on a bond, and Friedman was released that night. His lawyer handed over the missing jail keys. Friedman was charged with attempted burglary, possession of burglary tools, and evidence tampering. In his cooler, police had found a horseshoe-shaped key ring and a bolt cutter. From the trash bin in the passageway, they retrieved the papers Friedman had chewed. The markings on one were still legible, It was a hand-drawn schematic of the jail. Darren Hall is the antithesis of the stereotypical Southern sheriff. He doesn't like guns, and it's nearly impossible to find a photograph of him in uniform. He prefers to present his 6'4" frame, he was a kicker on his college football team, in well-tailored suits. With his open, often smiling face, white goatee, receding hairline, and glasses, Hall looks more like a politician than a sheriff. Now 61, he has been in the position longer than anyone else in Davidson County history, and he inspires fierce loyalty in his staff, many of whom have been with him since his first election. They trust Hall for the same reason that Friedman's admirers trusted Friedman. Hall is devoted to his work and very good at it. Back when his reelection was not guaranteed, he campaigned on the slogan, "It's what I do." Like Friedman, Hall can be self-important. The website of the sheriff's office lists every predecessor of his since 1783. The vanity is tempered by compassion. Even Nashville conservatives don't mind that Hall is a reform-minded Democrat who opposes the death penalty. "I don't think it's the right thing until they execute rich people," he told me. The Nashville police assigned a veteran detective, Robert Anderson, to the Friedman case. In the second week of January 2020, he sat down with Beasley, the electronic security officer, who was still combing through footage from the jail's cameras. He was startled to find that Friedman had been infiltrating the jail for months. His image popped up everywhere. Sometimes he was dressed as a supervisor, carrying a clipboard and wearing a dress shirt and khakis. Other times he impersonated a laborer in Hard Rock Cafe t-shirt and jeans, carrying a bucket. He wore an assortment of hard hats and reflective vests. One feature never changed, the dust mask. Video from cameras on the jail's exterior showed him walking to and from the jail in the mask. He could even be seen wearing it in a brief clip in which he was driving by the jail. Beasley marveled at his discipline. At the same time, Friedman was brazen. He occasionally climbed a ladder to cover a camera. Otherwise, he let himself be recorded, as though he wanted his ingenuity documented. He painted and used a drill and a grinder, but it wasn't clear from the videos just what he was working on. After reviewing video for nearly a month, Anderson went into the jail with an investigator from the Nashville Police's Crime Scene Investigation Section. In a recreation room where Friedman had been recorded working on a cinder block wall, they noticed that the mortar between certain blocks was crooked. The blemishes were subtle enough to escape the notice of anyone not looking for it. They found similar blemishes around the jail. They met with Conrad in the visitation room. In 10 booths separated by cinder block partitions, inmates could chat with visitors through glass while seated at metal counters. Friedman had been recorded kneeling for long periods below the counter in booth number 2. The investigator got on her knees and noticed that the white paint on one cinder block in the partition was less glossy than the paint on the others. She hit the block with a hammer. It crumbled easily. She pulled a plastic package out of the resulting hollow. Inside were a razor blade, 3 handcuff keys, and a security bit, a device used to fasten fixtures. Also in the hollow were a fully loaded revolver and 10 spare cartridges. Everyone fell silent. Even when Conrad had served in Iraq, the sight of a gun hadn't been so jarring. "When we found that first gun, things changed," he told me. Conrad, Anderson, and the investigator proceeded to a holding cell where Friedman had been recorded cutting around a metal mirror on a wall. The investigator pulled off the mirror, revealing a false wall, and, behind that, another package. This one contained a razor blade, 3 handcuff keys, and a fully loaded pistol with 8 spare cartridges. Behind a metal mirror in a bathroom, another fully loaded revolver and 11 cartridges. The police notified Friedman's lawyer, and on February 18th, Friedman surrendered to officers at his home. At a press conference announcing the arrest, it was clear that any respect Hall had once felt for Friedman was gone. His anger and sense of betrayal were obvious, as he told reporters. It was discovered that Mr. Friedman, over many months, had developed and implemented an extremely deliberate and, in my opinion, evil plan. He added, I'm not confident that we have found everything. In fact, he knew they hadn't. Friedman had worked in all of the jail's 14 cell blocks. Hall didn't have the equipment to properly search behind walls. The police didn't either. The FBI did, and Hall asked for its help. But when Matt Foster, an agent in the Bureau's Nashville office, visited the jail, the challenge posed by Friedman's scheme left him dumbstruck. This is nuts, Foster said to himself. He had seen jailbreak cases, but he had never heard of a case of someone breaking into a jail, much less into one that was 400,000 square feet, to deftly plant guns in its infrastructure. Nobody had. I searched our files, he told me, referring to the FBI's case file corpus, which dates back to 1908. Foster didn't see how the jail could be secured without tearing it apart. Nor did Hall, who feared that his baby would have to be demolished before it had opened. A judge set Friedman's bail at $2.5 million. Given his proven ability to sneak in and out of the sheriff's newest maximum security jail, Hall didn't want to risk housing him in any county facility. So he was sent to Riverbend Maximum Security Institution, a state prison in Nashville. He was put in solitary confinement. His wife and his lawyer could visit. Friedman, who was about to turn 51, sat on the wall-mounted bunk, thinking about how he'd ended up there. Alexander is the only child of Tony Joe Friedman, a Tennessean, and Victor Friedman, who grew up in Denver, where his parents, Croatian Jews, landed after fleeing the Nazis. Victor attended Harvard and was completing a master's in the Department of Aeronautics and Astronautics at MIT when Alexander was born in 1969. The family moved to Saudi Arabia, where Victor worked as a geophysicist at Aramco. They lived in the company's gated community in Dairon. Yearbook photos from the community's grade school show a smiling, demure young Friedman. He kept to himself, reading and drawing. The one classmate I found whom he befriended, Craig Proctor, told me that, to the few people he let in, Friedman was kind and generous, though never exactly warm. He dressed in button-downs like an adult and had a manner that was courtly beyond his years, as well as a keen sense of injustice. He defended kids who were bullied, though his anger was always very controlled, Proctor said. Small for his age, Friedman didn't fight the bullies. He taunted them with his superior vocabulary. He'd bludgeon with words, Proctor told me, adding that Friedman thought he was smarter than other people. Proctor sensed a severe tension between Friedman and his father, but didn't know its origin. There was no high school in Dairon, so Friedman's parents sent him to Mercersburg Academy, a boarding school in Pennsylvania, where he became depressed. Proctor, who also attended the school, found one thing that could animate his friend, playing Dungeons and Dragons. Friedman talked compulsively about one of his avatars, a thief rogue. It seemed to Proctor that Friedman wanted to live in the game. Friedman's time at Mercersburg ended during his second year when he attempted suicide by drinking chemicals. He was committed to a series of psychiatric hospitals. In a court-ordered examination later conducted by a psychologist in Nashville, Friedman traced his decline to his father, saying that he was strict and intellectual and never saw his son as a real person. He reenacted for the psychologist a scene of Victor forcing him to sit at the piano while commanding, "Practice, practice." The psychologist concluded that Friedman was a rather sad man, aloof and distrustful, but also prone to an upsurge of disruptive ideas. She added, an intellectual assessment was not done because it has already been determined that Alex has ability well above average. Friedman and his mother moved to Nashville in 1986 when Friedman was 17. Tony Joe's mother lived there, and Victor was still working in Saudi Arabia. Friedman's inner turmoil turned outward. He began behaving erratically, holding himself up in his room. Tony Joe, fearing that he had intended to harm her, called the police. Officers discovered a cache of handguns. Friedman claimed that he had found them. He wasn't arrested, but Tony Joe was frightened enough to relinquish custody of him and return to Saudi Arabia. Friedman, still a minor, became a ward of the state of Tennessee. Lawyers at Davidson County's juvenile court found the presence of this bright, courteous young man puzzling. He began attending the Tennessee Preparatory School, a state-run residential school for delinquent and neglected children, which had a forbidding reputation. Administrators shaved the heads of boys who tried to run away. Before Friedman arrived, two students killed themselves. A student sued the school, alleging that he was being kept there against his will, and the Tennessean reported that it was run like a correctional institution. In 1987, on the day after Thanksgiving, Friedman appeared at the locked glass door of the Coin Purse, a numismatic shop in Nashville. He wore a wig and a false mustache and carried a duffel bag containing a pistol. When the store's manager, Mike Gamble, buzzed him in, he noticed the wig and felt a pang of pity, assuming that Friedman was a cancer patient. Friedman asked Gamble to show him some gold coins in a display case. Gamble reached down to retrieve them. When he looked up, Friedman was holding the pistol inches from Gamble's forehead. "Clasp your hands behind your neck and face the wall," Gamble recalls him saying. Gamble had fended off inept robbers, but he sensed that Friedman, despite his amateurish disguise, was not inept. "The way he was instructing me on what to do," Gamble said, "suggested that he knew exactly what he was doing." As Friedman stuffed coins into the duffel bag, he asked Gamble where he hid cash. Gamble said that the only cash was in the register. "Lie to me and I'm going to kill you." "Twice more," Gamble recalls, "Friedman threatened to kill him. I had to make a decision," the manager told me. "Am I going to die with a bullet in the back of my head or one in the front?" He had a revolver tucked into his waistband, hidden by his blazer. Two customers, a father and his adult son, appeared outside the door. Friedman waved them off. They moved away, but sensing that something was amiss, didn't leave. When Friedman turned back around, Gamble was pointing his revolver at him. Gamble fired, and a shootout ensued, shattering the glass cases and filling the shop with smoke. Gamble hit Friedman's left hand. Running outside, Friedman, who had not emptied his gun of rounds, fired at the customers, missing both. In a parking lot, Friedman was cornered by police. One officer, Rob Forrest, aimed a revolver at Friedman, who raised his hands in surrender. His wig had flown off, but the fake mustache dangled from his lip. Forrest told me that, though Friedman looked ridiculous, he behaved like a seasoned criminal, refusing to say his name or answer any questions. Forrest searched Friedman and found a push dagger embedded in his belt buckle. In his breast pocket were what looked like two pins. Forrest removed the cap of one and found a switchblade. Under the other cap was an aerosol button. Forrest pushed it and winced as tear gas sprayed. "He was like James Bond," Forrest told me. "I'd never seen anybody anywhere close to this type of preparation for a struggle." Forrest brought Friedman to a hospital where his wounded hand was treated. Eventually, Friedman identified himself and confessed. "He didn't have any emotion in his voice," Forrest recalled. "It just seemed like he was unfazed by the events going on around him." Friedman, who was charged with armed robbery and three counts of attempted murder, was sent to Nashville's old central jail. He was there about 2 weeks when his grandmother secured his release with a bail bond. He went to live with her in Antioch, the Nashville suburb where Hall had grown up, but when she found a reservation for a one-way ticket to Australia in his room, she realized that he meant to flee the country and leave her on the hook for the bond. She called the bondsman, who returned Friedman to jail, where he tried to kill himself a third time with pills. A judge ordered a psychiatric evaluation. A psychologist concluded that Friedman suffered from dysmethia, today known as persistent depressive disorder, and schizoid personality disorder, writing that he showed indifference to social relationships and a restricted range of emotional experience and expression. He also had a tendency to blur fantasy with reality. Friedman was convicted of armed robbery and attempted murder, which normally would bring extended prison time in Tennessee. But the judge, perhaps taking pity on him, sentenced him to 20 years of supervised probation. He moved back in with his grandmother, took a vocational course in word processing, and worked as a clerk and an industrial packer. The psychologist who'd evaluated him gave him weekly counseling for depression, and he attended group therapy. He seemed to be improving. However, in 1991, Friedman, now 22, robbed a comic book store and then tried to steal trading cards from a Kroger supermarket. When a security guard confronted him, he brandished a pistol, ran outside, and drove off. Police followed him, and he crashed. The arresting officer recovered the pistol and then discovered a razor blade made to resemble a business card in Friedman's wallet. In his shirt pocket, the officer found a pen that was actually a stabbing pick. A knife was tucked in his shoe, and handcuff keys were hidden on his belt and under his shoe sole. He had a portable cassette player with a hidden compartment for a gun. When the officer asked Friedman how he had stashed the weapon so cunningly, he said that he had learned to do it while jailed in the criminal justice center. A judge ordered Friedman to serve out the remainder of his probation in prison. He was transferred to a private facility in Clifton, Tennessee, operated by Corrections Corporation of America, CCA. The company, which had been founded in Nashville in 1983, claimed that it could make detention facilities better for prisoners and more cost-effective for taxpayers, while enriching shareholders. The Clifton facility belied these claims. Its poorly trained officers were so terrified that they effectively ceded control to the prisoners who were brutalizing one another. In the Clifton facility, Friedman grew more sociable and discovered a boundless work ethic. He helped put out the prison's newspaper, and he launched his own investigative bulletin about the private prison industry. Declining to have a TV in his cell, he read everything he could get his hands on. He especially relished Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning and Alexander Solzhenitsyn's One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich. In a letter to me, Friedman quoted Denisovich, "How can you expect a man who's warm to understand a man who's cold?" In 1995, Friedman successfully applied to Mensa, whose members must present an IQ score that is at least in the 98th percentile, and he began publishing letters in that group's newsletter. Soon he was approaching bigger publications, eager to challenge ignorant portrayals of prisoners in the press. In a letter to the Tennessean, he corrected the syndicated columnist Mike Royko's reporting about Mumia Abu-Jamal, an activist who had been convicted, perhaps unfairly, of murdering a police officer. The Tennessean would go on to publish dozens of Friedman's letters. He began writing poetry and plays. Through his writing, he appeared to develop the social consciousness that his psychologist had thought he lacked. Friedman wrote a letter of apology to Mike Gamble, the manager of the Coin Purse. Friedman told me, "If I could alter my past to avoid that traumatic and life-altering encounter with Mr. Gamble, I would." He did not deserve to be an unwilling participant in that part of my reality. But he added, "Without that part of my past, that reality, I wouldn't have gone on to do the things I've since done, learned the things I've learned." In prison, Friedman studied civil law casebooks, and in 1995, he sued the commissioner of the Tennessee Department of Correction in federal court, claiming that the department had violated his free speech by suppressing his correspondence with prisoner newspapers at other facilities. He investigated CCA while he was in its prison in Clifton, obtaining documents and calling executives at the company's Nashville headquarters. He eventually sued the warden and several company employees for a continuous pattern of retaliation for exercising his First Amendment rights. Friedman was learning, as he told me, that it's just how the legal game is played, like chess. In 1999, PEN America awarded Friedman a first-place prize in its prison writing contest for his play, The Row, about prisoners condemned to death. The same year, a few months after his 30th birthday, he was granted parole. He entered the penitentiary a lamb, and he left a lion, one prisoner told me. When Hall became sheriff in 2002, he talked about replacing the jail, but knew that it would take years to accumulate the political power to do it. He continued to improve the facility, introducing treatment programs and cutting down on overcrowding, thereby earning the praise of Nashvillians, among them Friedman, now out of jail. He had moved back to Nashville to become an activist and a journalist. "If you want to affect change, you have to do it yourself," he told me. In a 2003 letter to the Tennessean, Friedman wrote that Hall should be commended for taking steps to ensure a safe and humane environment at the jail. Friedman wrote as a guest columnist at the Tennessean, pushing for criminal justice reform. state legislators invited him to testify before committee hearings, where he made for a captivating expert witness, a former prisoner so well-versed in the law that his arguments had to be taken seriously. Friedman had begun writing for Prison Legal News while incarcerated. By the mid-2000s, he had worked his way up the masthead to managing editor. Prison Legal News was published by the Human Rights Defense Center, where Friedman became an associate director. Friedman helped Janet Wolfe, his friend and fellow activist in Nashville, with a program that brought college students to visit prisons. Wolfe told me that Friedman, as an intellectual who had been incarcerated, was really good at bridging both sides, both listening to the young college students who were expressing terror about going in this place, but also helping the insiders find the language to tell their story. Friedman had realized, as he would tell me, that even unlikely battles can be won. He kept up the crusade against CCA that he had begun in the Clifton prison. In 2008, he successfully sued CCA in a landmark case that made private prison companies subject to Tennessee's Public Records Act. Most ingeniously, Friedman bought CCA stock so that he could attend shareholder meetings. During question and answer sessions, he waited for his turn at the microphone and then, in his level, dispassionate voice, asked board members awkward questions, such as why they allowed so many inmate rapes in their facilities. Rape was a special concern of Friedman's. After buying enough stock to allow him to propose shareholder resolutions, he drafted one requiring CCA to report to shareholders the number of rapes and sexual assaults in its facilities. The company rejected the measure, dismissing Friedman as a disgruntled ex-convict, but his campaign got widespread attention. He was profiled in Vice, Mother Jones, and The Guardian. He consulted on Last Week Tonight with John Oliver. Congress invited him to testify. In 2015, the staff of Bernie Sanders, who had begun campaigning for president, asked Friedman for advice on a bill that would have banned the federal government from employing private prison companies. The insider's insider was ready to help. By 2018, Sheriff Hall had finally accumulated the political power to build the new jail, and he convened an advisory group of local legislators, attorneys, and activists to revise the contract. Friedman was one of those activists. Between 2018 and 2019, the group held regular meetings. Hall appreciated Friedman's analytical rigor and calm presence. The group gave Hall a list of its recommendations, which included increasing visitation access and adding staff or programs, and most of the items were Friedman's. Hall's staff came to trust Friedman so much that when he asked them questions about the layout of the new jail, they answered. Outwardly, Friedman's life had never been better. He had finally settled down, and he had earned his place as one of America's foremost criminal justice activists. Yet, his friend Ferris Marone noticed that Friedman was increasingly agitated, at times claiming that the government was after him. He believed that at any time they were going to get him, Marone told me. Toward the end of 2019, Marone said, Friedman started telling him, the end is near. Sometimes he'd say it in Latin. Growing more concerned, Marone asked Friedman, what's going on with you? Are you thinking about doing something? Friedman's response was cryptic. It's all the stuff I've already done. The trial for the state of Tennessee versus Alexander Friedman began on July 18, 2022. When Friedman went into solitary confinement 2.5 years earlier, he had looked younger than his age. During that time, he sued the Tennessee Department of Correction for violating his due process and won. After 21 months in solitary, he was transferred to a standard cell. Still, when he entered the courtroom, he looked older than his 53 years. He had dropped 45 pounds and grown his goatee into a white beard that accentuated the gauntness of his once full face. 3 weeks before the trial, he sent me a letter saying, I expect it will be a train wreck, that is, disastrous, yet in a fascinating way that people can't look away from. He wrote, recently I was asked what justice means to me. The definition I found most apt is when someone gets what they deserve. Of course, that depends on who decides what is deserved. After Friedman's arrest, Hall's staff had combed through 2 million hours of footage from the downtown detention center's 600 cameras, compiling a reel of Friedman's every movement in the jail. They discovered that he had been infiltrating the building since at least August 2019, when the security cameras began going online, 5 months before he was caught. His familiarity with the layout in the earliest clips suggested that he had been at it much longer. Hall had asked the FBI for help searching the jail. By March of 2020, they found more than 20 hotspots where Friedman had embedded weapons. Crime scene investigators bored holes and pulled out a succession of neat plastic packages containing razors, saw blades, handcuff keys, and security bits. The prosecutors called these escape kits. Yet, all the evidence amounted to little in the way of serious indictable crimes. Friedman had stolen nothing from the jail except keys. His possession of burglary tools was a misdemeanor. The prosecutors couldn't confidently indict him for trespassing because when they watched the videos of his infiltrations, they learned that he'd never forced his way into the jail or used a false identity. It is a felony to introduce contraband into a penal facility, but Friedman technically hadn't done that either because the downtown detention center hadn't yet opened when he was inside it. Friedman's plot, extraordinary in its audacity, had the trappings of a major criminal undertaking. It's really rare that you have a case where somebody puts so much thought and attention into detail, Amy Hunter, one of the prosecutors, told me. Just as extraordinary was that Friedman, who knew as much about criminal law as many criminal lawyers do, appeared to have designed the plot precisely to confound prosecutors. There was one charge the prosecutors decided they could pursue, vandalism. In Tennessee, this is typically a misdemeanor. However, if an act of vandalism causes more than $250,000 in damage, it is a Class A felony. And if that damage is caused by someone with a serious criminal record, it can bring up to 60 years in prison. The prosecutors calculated, between the expenses of replacing all the locks and keys in the jail, paying overtime to staff who reviewed footage, and renting jail space for inmates who couldn't move in because of the investigation, Friedman had cost the sheriff's office the equivalent of $1.5 million. After deliberating for about an hour, the jury found Friedman guilty, as he had predicted. Friedman decided to speak at his sentencing hearing. He apologized to Sheriff Hall and to the prison reform community, whom I let down. He said, "While my life is effectively over, the need for meaningful reform remains." Although the judge acknowledged the need for prison reform, as he read out the sentence, 40 years, Friedman's face betrayed no emotion. Afterward, in a letter to me, Friedman said, "I had committed the unpardonable sin, endangering law enforcement officers." He went on, "If I recall correctly, around 10 people are killed by the police for every officer who dies in the line of duty, a disquieting ratio." Matt Foster, the FBI agent on the Friedman case, has retired from the Bureau. During his 26-year career, he interviewed bank robbers, escape artists, jihadists. Usually, he could boil their motivations down to profit, ideology, or revenge. Only in a very few cases did his subjects defy explanation. Friedman is among them. There's such a complex mixture of trauma, grudge, vengeance, and something else that we can't even articulate, Foster said. There are some minds that you just have to accept you are never going to get. His friend, Ferris Marone, believes that Friedman's plot was ultimately an elaborate way to get himself back in prison. He theorizes that Friedman had spent so many of his formative years incarcerated that, even after 2 decades of freedom and after all his professional success, he craved confinement. In some primal part of his brain that he couldn't reason his way out of, he longed to be a real insider again. Psychologists call this institutionalization, Marone said. He mentioned once that he was ready to go back. He knew about prison. He knew how things functioned. At times, in Friedman's letters to me, he seemed to be playing a game. He wouldn't discuss his case, but he dropped coy hints. Once, he sent me an old article about a 1982 case in which a prisoner smuggled a gun into the Brushy Mountain State Penitentiary west of Knoxville and went on a shooting spree. Friedman didn't explain why he sent it, but a year later in his letter to the judge, he cited the Brushy Mountain incident as his inspiration to smuggle guns into the jail. He may have wanted to engage Sheriff Hall in a battle of wits, leaving a trail of clues behind for a cunning opponent. He knew he was being recorded by the jail's cameras, and he always wore the telltale dust mask. He surely noticed that the circular key ring he left in the key control room was unlike every other key ring in the jail. Still, for days, he let it hang there. Its lock cracked instead of replacing it. Clues were still turning up long after the downtown detention center opened in May 2020. More than 3 years later, Hall's staff found a correctional officer's uniform that Friedman had stowed in the jail's ductwork. Although crime is down in Nashville, the downtown detention center has been plagued by overcrowding. Last year, Hall announced that he wants to build another jail. When I last visited him in Nashville, there was a new addition to his headquarters, a little museum chronicling the history of the Davidson County Sheriff's Office and its most notorious inmates. There are enlarged mugshots of Paul Dennis Reed, Jr., better known as the fast food killer, who was sentenced to death after murdering 7 people during a string of robberies at chain restaurants, and of Bruce Mendenhall, also known as the truck stop killer, who is serving multiple life terms. In Pride of Place is an exhibit titled Alexander Friedman's Plot Against the Downtown Detention Center. The crime is memorialized with a dust mask, one of the recovered revolvers, and the circular key ring. A plaque reads, "It all started with a set of keys." Friedman began appealing his conviction in 2023. Last summer, the appeal was denied. In December, the Tennessee Supreme Court declined to review the case. Friedman is now in the Bledsoe County Correctional Complex in Pikeville, where he is still writing. He has been contributing to the online magazine of the Prison Journalism Project, covering minor injustices such as the comparatively high cost that his Muslim prison mates have to pay for Qurans. He has not lost his sense of humor. Recently, he wrote an essay called The Art of the Prison Fart. In 2022, his play 20 Years in Solitary earned him another first place award from PEN America. In a letter he sent me after his conviction, Friedman included a poem he had composed, or rather recomposed. It was based on I Have a Rendezvous with Death by the American poet Alan Seeger, who died at the Somme while fighting with the French Foreign Legion. Friedman renamed it I Have a Rendezvous with Fate, with gratitude and apologies to Alan Seeger. He wrote, "Confined in a dark, barren cell, resigned to my own private hell, which nurtures both despair and hate, I have a rendezvous with fate. So that when I draw my final breath, I'll embrace the soft release of death." In his last letter, Friedman said that he no longer wanted to communicate with me. He signed off with a quote in French from Rabelais. It is believed to have been the writer's dying words. Tirez le rideau, la farce est jouée. Drop the curtain, the farce is over. The previous article was edited for length. And now, from the April 27th, 2026 issue of the New Yorker, The Anatomy of a Failure, from spray-on condoms to radioactive wrinkle cream, flops at the Musée d'Art des Métiers in Paris, puts terrible inventions in the spotlight, by Lauren Collins. Why not come up with a condom that fits the man rather than vice versa, a German entrepreneur named Jan Vincent Krauss once asked. His solution, the spray-on condom, which involves coating a penis with liquid latex, made it to the prototype stage only to encounter a fatal problem. The latex took up to 3 minutes to fully dry. Pfft. This is just one among hundreds of cautionary case studies awaiting visitors to FLOPS, an exhibition at Paris's Musée d'Art et Métiers, focusing on the failure, bust, bomb, fiasco, debacle. Behold the V-shaped keyboard, the hydrogen helicopter, the roller skating Barbie that sets the rug on fire. We thought it would be interesting to show that which we never show, Marjolaine Schuch, who co-curated Flops, explained recently, "All this stuff that gets shoved under the carpet, the show originated at a design museum in Saint-Étienne. Musée d'Art et Métiers has supplemented it with lemons from its permanent collection, such as the 10-hour decimal time clock used during the French Revolution. This is the Pascaline," Schuch said, pointing to what looked like a jewelry box covered in brass gears, an early, not entirely dependable calculating machine conceived by Blaise Pascal. In mounting the show, Schuch and her team committed a gaffe of their own. "We didn't include the dates of the inventions, and we immediately started getting all kinds of comments," she confessed. The Pascaline's label bore evidence of their cleanup job, a rubber-stamped edition reading 1642. Nearby, a screen displayed emails between the investors Paul Graham and Fred Wilson. "I'm not sure they can take on the hotel market," Wilson writes, deciding against investing in Airbnb. Graham published the exchange on his blog in 2011 as a testament to the fact that even successful people don't always get it right. That such a blunder might be shrugged off and even celebrated rather than shamefully shunted away struck Schuch as a very American notion. "In France, we never talk about these steps, this groundwork, these impasses," Schuch said. "This was an opportunity to demystify and de-dramatize failure. This idea that making a mistake is something rather serious from which one doesn't necessarily recover." Not every downfall has an upside, as early adopters of Though Radia, a line of thorium and radium-based face creams promoted by Dr. Alfred Curie, no relation to Marie, soon learned. And then there's the London's walkie-talkie building, a skyscraper whose convex shape caught the sun like a magnifying glass, melting cars. In addition to such dangerous flops, the exhibit features inventions that fizzled because they were expensive and unnecessary. The Juicero juicing machine, poorly designed. The Vasa, a Swedish warship that sunk on its maiden voyage, or simply ahead of their time. La Jamais Content, a speedy electric car that came out in 1899. Everybody forgets that electric vehicles were invented at the same time as combustion-powered vehicles, Schuch said. A case nearby contained an old Michelin guide listing charging stations in every city. Of all the categories of failures, perhaps the most jaw-dropping is the faux pas, demonstrating, according to the museum's literature, at best tactlessness and at worst bad intentions. A crowd gawked at such specimens as a hollow golf club that one can urinate into, and the pastel-toned Bic for her ballpoint pen, designed to fit comfortably into a woman's hand, though perhaps not into her wallet, as the product cost up to 70% more than non-gendered pens. In 2014, Zara released a blue and white striped child shirt embellished with a yellow star. It was meant to evoke a sheriff's uniform, but for many, it called to mind concentration camps. Schuch led the way through a room wallpapered with whimsical non-starters dreamed up by the artist Jacques Caroman, a sinuous ping-pong table, transparent playing cards. A section devoted to transportation offered such wonders of disappointment as a shuttle bus proposed for the La Défense district near Paris that progressed twice as slowly as a person on foot. The food processing sector proved equally inadequate. Colgate lasagna, anyone? Schuch paused in front of Tetra Pak, carton of Côte du Rhône, noting that while such packaging had gone over fine in Nordic countries, French consumers had rejected it vehemently. "Wine in a carton," she said, shaking her head. "It's impossible psychologically." In the final gallery, a line had formed in front of an arcade game-shaped kiosk where museum-goers could play something called Flop or Top, voting on the desirability of new inventions. 60% so far were in favor of an invisibility cape made from lenticular lenses. More than 90,000 people had visited the exhibition with a month to go. "It's not a lot for some museums, but it's enormous for us," Schuch said. Only somewhat inconveniently, Flops was a big success. And as usual, I'll end with some poetry. From the March 30th, 2026 issue of The New Yorker, Midnight in the pain relief aisle of CVS, thinking about the cloud of unknowing. Pain ricochets around my skull, like an aspirin commercial from the 60s, darting up the nasal passages, up behind the frown. The temporal bones clutching at God like a desperate spark. He bound you to him by a chain of such longing. Ridiculous, pressing and pressing the button for an attendant, aching jaw, temples throbbing. When did they start locking everything up? Do I need something? This man wants to know. Contact lens solution? Root touch-up? Where is my mind? My mother said this morning. Is Daddy dead? How did he die? Do not fret after God, my book says. Well, I do fret. I'm fretted as a guitar, picking out the same chords, arpeggios of dread, wandering 24-hour chains, rehearsing my facts, one big cloud of forgetting. There are 300 muscles in the face, the time bone, the temple is called, where our hair grays first. Why aren't the aisles marked? My God, what is that shrieking? The man doesn't work here, he says. Reconcile yourself to wait in the darkness. What did I think spiritual desert meant? Surely not that lump of nothing I was an hour ago on the couch, wielding the remote, spooning mango sorbet out of a container. It should feel, I explain to the self-checkout screen. How did I get here? Punching in my customer number, more important. What saints felt, a dreadful hunger. If you need help, the self-checkout voice is saying, Todo y nada, todo y nada, it whispers, here in the aching all-night fluorescent. We've run out of time for today's episode of the New Yorker Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. We'd love to hear from you. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.